Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas. Today I'm broadcasting from the Engelsberg Seminar, a gathering of academics and policymakers from around the world in Sweden. And this year's seminar takes the market as its theme. To discuss the market, advertising, counterculture, Mad Men, Nike, Apple, I'm joined by Ian Leslie, a writer and author of acclaimed books on human behaviour. His first career was in advertising as a creative strategist for some of the world's biggest brands, and he now writes about psychology, culture, technology and business for numerous outlets and runs a fantastic Substack, The Ruffian. I do urge people to subscribe. It's always wonderfully thought-provoking and brilliantly put together. Ian, welcome to the podcast. Advertising, the counterculture, mass market, where does your story begin?
My story begins really at the beginning of the 1970s, the end of the decade of the counterculture, this kind of social revolution that happens or begins in the 1960s, the late 1960s. And one kind of image that captures it is the image of Don Draper from Mad Men meditating at a retreat in California. So for those who have watched it, or those who haven't, the finale of Mad Men involves Don Draper, who's a boomer, essentially, who is a very conservative kind of 1950s man, dresses in well-cut suits at all times, very kind of traditionally masculine. And as we follow Draper through the 1960s, we see him becoming progressively disoriented by these crazy kids, these hippies with their sort of flowery shirts and reefers and political protests. And you see him kind of fascinated by this, but also disoriented by this. And he slightly kind of has to navigate his way through this cultural change. And right at the end of the whole series, Don is doing two things. He's trying to crack a new campaign for Coca-Cola for his ad agency, McCann Erickson. And at the same time, he's going on a road journey, which is also kind of personal and spiritual trip from New York to California, having a kind of nervous breakdown along the way. And the final image is of him at this retreat in California where they sell Coke. They have a Coke machine, which he fixes because he's the only kind of grown up there. And the final image is of him sitting and meditating and then having a little smile. And we can tell he's having a thought. And he's cracked the campaign. And we merge to, I'd like to teach the world to sing, this classic Coca-Cola ad, one of the most famous ads ever made. And this group of kind of hippie-ish young people from all, you know, religions and ethnicities standing on a hill singing what sounds like a kind of song for global peace, which is also an ad for Coke. And you can see what's happening in Don's mind is, hey, this crazy kind of counter-cultural stuff that the kids are into, I can use that to sell sugared water. And it was both a kind of brilliant way to end the series, and it's also a kind of telling moment in the history of advertising and consumer capitalism, where big brands learned to co-opt and take advantage of this kind of oppositional, disruptive, anti-establishment, in some ways, anti-market activity and energy that was part of the 60s revolution, and co-opt it in the service of selling more stuff. Now, I actually don't think that this approach, which in the fictional world Don Draper lands upon, but in the real world was a real thing, really got going until 15, 20 years later. It kind of reached its apotheosis. And it did that because I think the next generation, it was the children of the 1960s, the kids who lived through it, when they grew up and they started founding businesses or became senior in marketing organizations and ad agencies, they were still really imbued with this ethos of the 1960s. And they weren't cynical about it. They kind of loved it. At the same time, they were really interested in making a lot of money, being very successful. And they used that countercultural ethos and spirit to build enormous global brands, the most prominent ones being Apple and Nike. When I entered advertising, because that was my first career was in advertising, and I entered the industry at the kind of end of the 90s, early 2000s, and Apple and Nike and a few others, but particularly those two, were the brands that everyone referred to. And they were hugely influential in the way that every brand marketed itself. And this idea that you should be a kind of almost an ideological, quasi-political challenger to the status quo became picked up by every brand. So just going back in the Apple story for a bit, the first kind of expression of that is the 1984 ad, which was literally made in 1984, when Apple is a kind of upstart competitor to IBM, and they portray this kind of futuristic, dystopian, literally kind of Orwellian scenario. And this brilliant young individual woman, you know, runs down the center of all these gray suits, chanting at a screen of Big Brother, smashes the screen. And the line at the end is, why 1984 won't be like 1984, Apple computers for the rest of us. And it was this act of enormous chutzpah on Apple's part. It was a huge ad. It was in the Super Bowl. Didn't feature any computers. It didn't feature any consumers. It was a pure act of kind of political, quasi-political symbolism, all in the service of saying you should buy our computers rather than IBM's, right? So there was a kind of brute commercial logic to it. But it introduced this new approach to advertising, which was say, we're not just here to sell you stuff, we're here to change the world. Yeah. So they pick up that kind of idealistic, far-reaching ethos of the 1960s that says, actually, there's more to the market than just buying and selling. There's more to consumerism than just buying a new refrigerator. Mm. That's stupid. What we're here to do is to really make a difference to the world. And he puts that kind of ethos in the service of Apple. And it really finds its finest expression at about 10 years later when he introduces, when Apple introduced the Think Different campaign, where they present a kind of series of intellectual visionaries, kind of creative people from Einstein to Picasso to Alfred Hitchcock. And they have this kind of inspiring voiceover that says, you know, it's the crazy ones who make progress in this world. It's the ones who won't accept the status quo the way things are.
Is this, in a sense, already there in the kind of Soissons Huitard atmosphere, that the fantasy, the symbol, the role of film, I guess, is so important? I mean, I'm thinking of that Bertolucci film, The Dreamers, which is a kind of about a group of three young people in Paris who are obsessed with living out films. And actually that segues into their kind of youthful Maoism, this kind of obsession with particular artifacts of the communist world, you know, posters, imagery. So it's like it's already there, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. It's already there. Well, you think about the Situationists, and one of their kind of slogans was demand the impossible, which is just, I mean, in fact, Adidas's slogan is nothing is impossible, or impossible is nothing, if I remember. And so you can see this kind of direct transfer of that kind of rebellious anti-establishment attitude. Nike really leaned heavily into rebellious kind of sports stars. So they sponsored, they looked for people like Andre Agassi, who are actively kind of anti-establishment. Mm. And every brand after that, you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s, 2000s, wanted to be, to have a kind of enemy that they were standing against. They were saying, well, this is how we want to change the world. We're standing, I remember, you know, even a biscuit brand would say, you know, we're standing against the tyranny of the digestive biscuit. And we're going to smash the system. IKEA, when it came to Britain, did a big campaign about chucking out your chintz. And it was about transforming the country. It wasn't just about come to our stores and buy our nice furniture. Yeah. And so it became this whole way of selling stuff, which was more about kind of ideology or quasi-politics, in which we have a manifesto and a set of beliefs, and this is how we're trying to change the world. And that was really the kind of the dominant way of branding when I was in the industry in the kind of early 2000s. And then that kind of period came to an end really about, you know, I would say around 2010, roughly. And certainly by now, it's just not done anymore. It's not really an accessible form. So I think it's an interesting window that just opens up for about 20 years or so and then closes.
Do you think it's a genuinely global phenomenon, or does it still bear the sort of hallmarks of kind of dynamic American capitalism?
Yeah, it is very American-centric and British. And those are the two kind of big centres of advertising ideas, or they certainly were. Mm. I think it always had less purchase in... So, for instance, I worked on a campaign for a German insurer. And for some reason, they'd hired a London agency, a London office of a global agency, and I was working on that campaign. And we wrote a kind of creative brief for them, which was along these lines, right? So it was very much about individual self-expression and standing against, I can't remember, whatever, and having brilliant ideas. There's a great focus on creativity in all these kind of campaigns, and brilliant ideas. And the German client just flat out said, I mean, he was very polite about it, but he said, no, this is completely wrong for us. And I remember the most crispest expression of why it was wrong was he said, in Germany, we don't have ideas, we make plans. And it was like, ah, right, you just have a completely different kind of ethos from the one that I've grown up with in British advertising and American advertising. So no, it didn't extend everywhere, but in those two kind of the powerhouses of advertising and marketing thought, it was dominant.
So how is it? You said that has kind of filtered out in some ways. What's replaced it? Is there another dynamic force that motivates that kind of rhetoric of selling and self-empowerment?
Well, really, the whole industry has changed so that it's become less about these kind of big cultural movements and ideas and stories. It's much more systematized and technologized now. It's much more about sending you the right sales messages at the point of purchase. Okay. And the kind of formats for bigger kind of storytelling type approaches like TV advertising are just in decline. People aren't spending as much or taking as much care over TV ads or even posters as they used to, certainly not press, right, or print. And so the industry's really becoming a different beast.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the cultural and political environment has changed. Part of the reason is that those brands were incredibly successful at selling these stories and became the biggest companies in the world. So, you know, Apple can no longer pose as the anti-establishment upstart disrupting the status quo. It is the status quo. It's one of the biggest companies in the world. Nike, similarly, is a huge global behemoth. So that kind of story is no longer available to them. And then for other brands, the political environment is just, and media environment is much more kind of fragmented and polarized. So you might have a kind of quasi-political stance, but it actually becomes a very political stance. And you have to say, well, is this what we want to do? Are we just going to appeal to left-wing progressives or right-wing conservatives? Ben & Jerry's has actually taken the route of just saying, we're no longer for everyone who fancies a bit of like hippie-ish ice cream. We are for young progressive students and activists, and we take political stances. So, yeah, these kind of big world-changing but still fairly kind of universalist stories are not really available to brands anymore.
So I'm thinking about the kind of political ads you had in the 90s and early 2000s. And I guess people who may be quite suspicious of that collision of, you know, medium is the message, cleverness and politics. I'm thinking of Bill Clinton's The Man from Hope ads, which is an extremely brilliant political advertisement. Watching it now, it's hard not to be very cynical that it's not some kind of elegant trick. You know, it's all kind of this feel-good, sheeny quality to it. And I guess New Labour in Britain also was affected very much by marketing technique. Do you think people just sort of are just instinctively more cynical?
Yeah, I mean, the political category is such a sort of distinctive category. It borrows some of the techniques from commercial marketing, but it's a world unto itself, really. But what they have in common is that people are more savvy and more cynical about big brands and particularly about politicians. Mm. And these kind of big, sweeping, optimistic approaches are harder to do. And again, there's just much more focus on social media sort of targeting, precision targeting, and less on big narrative approaches. And in some ways, that's a problem because, you know, look at the Labour leader at the moment. They've almost kind of lost the ability to tell big stories and big narratives. And it becomes this kind of self-reinforcing spiral. But because they don't bother doing that, people get more cynical.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not a great place.
It's not. Yeah, it's one hard to talk about kind of national projects. I mean, what Starm often says, he's into renewal. And so this is his attempt to say, this is what my project is. But it's kind of slightly abstracted. And it's like, that's a safe thing to say. Well, I'd like renewal. I guess the other thing I wanted to ask is, it's the vociferous nature of modern publics makes those kind of big messages much harder to deliver. The other kind of aspect to it, I guess, is a tribute to the intrinsic dynamism of the capitalist system. How does it co-opt criticism? How does it use oppositional forces to achieve commercial ends and sell things?
I think that is how it is. It's so impressive in a way that consumer capitalism is so, or has been, we'll see how it handles the energies of the next 10, 20 years. But what we've seen so far is that it's got this incredible ability to tap kind of grassroots cultural energy from wherever it comes from, even if it is superficially kind of oppositional to capitalism or to the market and so on, and say, well, yeah, but this is really interesting, creative, young people are into it. Maybe we can find a way to kind of flip it back. And so there's this kind of like endlessly inventive, flexible, malleable kind of form of consumer capitalism, which I think is both terrifying and very impressive.
Yeah. And just before we wrap up, you mentioned Nike, Apple, Think Different, Just Do It, these kind of iconic brands. I'm also thinking of the way Lance Armstrong used a kind of almost advertising techniques, is getting everyone to wear a wristband with Livestrong on it.
Yeah.
It was all part of a kind of personality cult that he created around, you know, not just his personal journey, but a kind of fight against a bigger thing. He wasn't just a cyclist, he was taking down cancer, which we all agree is terrible. And he used that as a very sophisticated technique to shut down opposition. But what I'm getting at is, do you think it helps or hinders companies to focus so much on an ethical vision alongside merely delivering a service?
A couple of things on this.
Yeah.
One is that Steve Jobs approach of kind of putting a dent in the universe, changing the world, that kind of idealistic approach, which he was so, you know, he was a genius at, has been absolutely influential. And even if it sort of died out in terms of advertising and marketing, you now see it's in Silicon Valley, just in the world of startups and tech companies. This is how they all talk, right?
Yeah.
They are the ones who still carry that kind of, you know, idealistic flame, even as the rest of the world kind of looks at them and goes, really?
Yeah.
Okay. But the other kind of lingering manifestation of it is in corporate purpose statements, brand purpose statements, which you see now everywhere. Companies like Unilever, these very boring companies, will say, we have a bigger purpose. We're not just about selling stuff. And we're trying to change the world to make it more equal. We're trying to increase, you know, the diversity and equity of the world. It's kind of like familiar language now. And again, some of them are running into problems because it turns out some of the stuff is actually more political and hot-button than contested than the, perhaps they had realised. But the slightly kind of more boring kind of form of it is, I think, where that countercultural ethos ended up. It became, in a way, the kind of boring corporate mainstream boilerplate.
Yeah. Well, Ian, that was really fascinating. Thanks so much for your wonderful speech, and it's a great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.